Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 4, where we will be talking with Dr. Amy H. Sturgis about Harry Potter and Native America, fantasy, imagination, and indigenous futurism. To Reading, Writing, Rolling. I'm your host, Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Our resident expert is John Granger, called the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars. He is the author of several books on Harry Potter and other works of fantasy fiction, like Twilight. And he has just offered a series of online Potter courses, Potter Summer School. How's that going, John, and what's next for you?
Hey, we just finished the summer school. People from all over the planet, Australia, China, Russia.
Argentina,
yeah. Sergio Tarantino and his crowd in Argentina, Buenos Aires. We just finished summer school, and we're opening the seven-week class. It's probably, we're almost halfway done or done before this will be on air. We're going to do the seven Keys to Harry Potter in 7 weeks, 3 classes a week, office hours, webinars with people like Beatrice Gross. We had her on during summer school. It's amazing. We've actually invented a platform now for, you know, where Potter pundits can meet with serious readers of Harry Potter and talk affordably, accessibly, interactively, profoundly. I mean, it's an
educational kind of environment. I love that.
How about it? We finally have done it. You can now study with the best Harry Potter scholars anywhere on the planet for next to nothing. Anyway, so we're all excited about that.
That's obviously Exciting.
That's what I'm doing, Katie.
All right. Yeah, that's a lot of work. That's a lot of work putting that together. And I love that new technologies are making it possible to study in these new innovative ways. I admit I'm still a traditionalist. But it is exciting to be able to, you know, to have B. Groves as your teacher, you know, to have you as the teacher, John. I think that's got to be exciting for a lot of people.
Yeah, anyway, I've been working on this for 15 years, I think, almost as long as I've known Amy. Hey! really the goddess of podcasts and all things online study. Anyway, I've been following in her wake for years. God willing, Amy will be on one of the webinars during the Wizard Reading Formula 7-week course.
Ooh, yes.
Yay.
Yeah, that sounds great. So without further ado then, let me introduce our guest for today, who is a very good friend of mine, Dr. Amy H. Sturgis. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Katie. Hi, John. Thank you for having me.
Gosh. Well, Amy, just to introduce you to our listeners, just in case they haven't encountered you before, which is hard to believe, but just in case, Amy teaches at Lenoir Rhine University and also at the Innovative Mythgard Institute at Signum University. She may very well have been the first person to offer a college-level course in Harry Potter studies, and she still regularly teaches both undergraduate classes on Harry Potter as well as undergraduate and graduate classes on Harry Potter, as well as other topics, both historical and literary. In 2006, Amy won the Imperishable Flame Award for Tolkien's Inkling Scholarship. That's amazing. And she continues to be part of the Hugo Award-winning podcast, Starship Sofa. Now, is that one of the only podcasts to win a Hugo Award, Amy?
It was the very first in 2010. Yes.
That's great.
Thank you. These
are Amy's sci-fi, fantasy, and Harry Potter credentials. But Amy, you and I met when we both attended Vanderbilt University for our PhDs in history.
That's
you are
right.
A rock-solid historian as well. You received your degree in intellectual history, and your dissertation was about Cherokee constitutions, with what was perhaps considered a radical idea that Native American people have intellectual history too, right? That they're making, you know, they've got basically political philosophy going on there right at the time of the nation's founding too.
Exactly.
You've also continued with your Native American scholarship in writing books. For example, you've got a book about Tecumseh called Tecumseh, A Life, and your book, The Trail of Tears and Indian Removal. And so before we get into all the details about those intersections between your sci-fi fantasy and your Native American history, you know, interests that you have, we usually start with our icebreaker question, which is, when did you first encounter Harry Potter? But you and I both know that I already know the answer to this question.
That is very true, and that I'm here today because of you, because you're the one who put Harry Potter in my hands to begin with.
Yeah, I literally gave you the book, and I said, read it. I'll see you later, and I will ask you about it.
You did, and the rest is history. I'm so grateful to you for that.
Yeah, and I know that you like the things that are, you know, a little more on the disturbing end. You like the horror, you know, you like the things that, you know, tell you the tough parts of the story. And I thought, even though this is children's literature, you know, it starts with a double murder. There's a guy drinking unicorn blood. It ends with exorcising a parasite from the back of a man's head, like, suitably dark for Amy Sturgis. And I'm so glad that you liked it too.
This is terrible. It sounds like Amy's in her basement sharpening an axe. You know, this is terrible.
You don't know, John.
Gosh.
No, but it's good. And you know, I think that some of those darker elements like are the reasons why it's that those books continue to be so important. And that they resonate with a lot of people.
I agree.
All those people with two people in the back of their heads. That's right. All right. Yeah, okay.
Well, but there's a powerful imagery there.
You're not going to get an argument out of me,
Katie.
I wrote, you know, chapters on the Gothic and Harry Potter, so I'm right with you.
Absolutely.
Right with
you. So let's ask the second part of the question, which I can ask you a little more sincerely than the first one. Which is, when did you realize, Amy, that Harry Potter was literature worth taking seriously from a scholarly academic perspective?
Well, part of that goes back to the first part of the question, because, to be honest, I bought that from the very beginning, because you did. And I know you well enough to have full faith in your intellectual judgment. So because you took it seriously, I did before I ever read it. And so the question would be whether or not, you know, I would like it personally. But either way, I would take it seriously. And your work, my work, as historians, I think we both have a healthy inoculation against snobbishness, because we appreciate that the popular is not a bad thing. And
right.
Over time, you know, we don't thumb our noses at things just because they happen to be successful. I knew I wanted to sort of act on it seriously, probably about the time of Prisoner of Azkaban. That book was a game changer for me, because opening it up to the earlier generation, bringing in the Marauder era, the material, the idea that there's this legacy of loss, and it's such a Gothic book, mm-hmm. and it brought in so many, and I was already thinking this would be a great way to talk about, because I could see those ingredients, and I could see, of course, that she was using things in the earlier books as well, but that just captured me, and I realized that there was a lot more depth and texture there once that opened up and we saw what these earlier generations had, you know, real faces, real characters, and there was going to be a meaty sort of intergenerational dialogue here about everything that had happened. And
so you saw they were historical.
Exactly.
There's a whole history back there that's influencing what's playing out.
Right, exactly.
I want to break in here and say that fandom probably has no idea this is the case, but Katie referred to it just as an aside that Amy was one of the first to teach this. Only Katie, only Amy, and Michael Marr, who was a visiting professor at Stanford. They were the first to teach classes on Harry Potter. And in 2000, this was in 2001, 2002, Amy? I mean, this was so far ahead of the field. It was the height of the Potter panic that, you know, Marr, who's a Nabokov scholar of the first rank, and Amy Sturgis, an historian and a fantasy expert. I mean, when Amy wrote Harry as a Hobbit and blew the doors open on a basically the Tolkien community was hostile to Harry Potter at the time, that someone that was taken as seriously as Amy is in that community came out and said, no, this is important work. Really, we're just absolute game changers. Those of you who didn't live through it, you have no idea how important Amy's contribution was to all the entire field of Potter studies.
That's very kind. Thank you, John. You know, that essay you just mentioned referenced your work. You were there first. So,
the
love fest that is this episode. But seriously, I'm truly honored that you would say that because you helped pave the way for what I wanted to do. So thank you.
Yeah, and I do think that it's a process of kind of opening it up to multiple audiences, you know, and you got to try to get the Tolkien people right, and then you got to try to convince academic communities that it's something worth looking at. And, you know, I think every step along the way there is important in making sure that people do pay attention to it as a really important literary work.
Absolutely. And I'm grateful to Belmont University, which is where I was teaching at the time, for being willing to take that leap of faith with me in that course. When I pitched it, I didn't really know what the reaction would be. I was really fortunate that they bet on it, and they let me have that experience and that experiment, and it
right.
proved successful.
Yeah, yeah, and look how many Harry Potter classes there are out now.
Absolutely.
But a good thing, a very good thing. So, Amy, tell us a little bit about your background in these two areas of Native American literature and history, and also your interest in fantasy and science fiction literature. You know, how did you come by these interests, and what do you think are the links between these two areas of your scholarship?
Well, on the one hand, I grew up in the former so-called Indian Territory of Oklahoma, so I drank in the history and cultures there from an early age, and part of my own background is Cherokee, so that interest naturally followed me through my education. And as you pointed out during my PhD work, I was interested in constitutional issues, and I knew about the Cherokee clan law and early law, the evolution of Cherokee law, constitutional thought with a small c, and then how that common law became written and ratified constitutions, and nobody was really doing that. The constitutional studies people weren't interested in the Native American side. The Native American people weren't really interested in the intellectual history side. So there was a little moment there where I could step in. And so
it can be really hard to bridge those two areas, though. I mean, we were just talking about Tolkien and Harry Potter, right? But sometimes when you're bridging those two communities who haven't been talking to each other in an academic setting, it can be jarring as well.
Absolutely. And you don't really know where you fit.
Right?
Yes, there were some early conferences that were, I had some fun experiences. But in the end, I was, again, you know, fortunate in this case with Vanderbilt that they worked with me, and I had a really eclectic and interesting committee from different disciplines. And so I did that. And then I went on, as you pointed out, and I have taught Native American studies, and I've written books on the Trail of Tears and Tecumseh, and written essays on various Indigenous American topics. Similarly, from childhood, I don't remember a time without thinking about the Cherokee Nation in particular, and certainly the other nations that were there that I encountered as living, vibrant peoples there in Oklahoma. Also from childhood, by the time I was five, I was watching reruns of Star Trek religiously, and I saw Star Wars in the theater when I was five, and I was hooked on speculative fiction. It just changed those two, that sort of 1-2 punch, just just captured my imagination in an incredibly powerful way. And eventually, raised by people from Mary Shelley to Frank Herbert, I came to appreciate that what Ray Bradbury said about SF being the literature of ideas was true. Science fiction is the genre in which the ideas are the heroes. So as someone who specializes or went on to specialize in intellectual history, the history of ideas, there's really no better subject than science fiction. And because I was reading Native authors and aware of them, I knew that Native writers have been writing SF for a long time. And similarly, non-Natives had been writing SF using elements drawn from Native America. Some well, many not very well at all. And so really a turning point for me, and Katie, here's another turning point in my life you were there for. I was invited as the scholar guest of honor for MythCon in 2006, mm-hmm. the year it was in Norman, Oklahoma, and the theme was fantasy in Native America. And I was probably invited for that honor because I was pretty much the only scholar around who did both Native American studies and science fiction and fantasy. But my keynote speech turned into the springboard for a book project, which I ended up co-editing, called The Intersection of Fantasy in Native America. And that includes essays about indigenous fantasists and about non-natives using Native America in their work. And that forced me to appreciate that this intersection really is a fruitful place to be. And I couldn't imagine, but it's now 11 years later, a much more fruitful place to be. But since then, I've spent my time often both teaching and writing, looking at the place where these two meet. And I've written work, for example, tracing the way that Star Trek over its 50-year history has treated the subject of Native America, mm-hmm. which is quite interesting. And people have been.
And I bet it's there metaphorically, even sometimes when it's not so obviously there.
Exactly. It's there literally, where you have Native characters and a whole diaspora of indigenous peoples who leave Earth and try to go someplace else. But you also have it very much, like you say, metaphorically talking about the, you know, what is the colonial, what is the imperial, what mm-hmm. is the, you know, forced removal of peoples, etc.
All right.
So I'm very grateful right now we're in a moment that has an explosion of young, talented Native writers in world science fiction. It's a very, very good time to be interested in both of these fields. And I'm delighted to be here talking with you about this because I think it's a critical moment to be here in this intellectual place.
Well, Amy, your answer is the perfect answer because it leaves you thinking, why weren't more people combining these two together? It makes so much sense as you describe it in the way that you have. And I'm glad to see that those links are becoming more and more evident to a wider variety of people. Now, somebody who is a non-Indigenous author who I suppose accidentally perhaps dabbled in portrayal of Native Americans in a fantasy context is J.K. Rowling on her Pottermore essays about the history of magic in North America. And she, in a very kind of glancing way, she does present some aspects of Native American culture and tries to connect somehow the magic in the Native American setting to the people who are magical people coming over from Europe. You wrote in December 2016 an article for Reason in which you talked about J.K. Rowling's failures in this presentation. I almost, instead of talked about, I had lots of other verbs that I had there instead that you criticized was the nicest one that I came up with.
Eviscerate is good.
Eviscerate is good too, right? yes, it's pretty much a takedown, and
yeah.
It's so hard to do that with one of your heroes. And I know you love J.K. Rowling, like I love J.K. Rowling, and she has really she has messed up here. You were on MuggleNet Academia to talk about this critique at length. We don't want to replicate that discussion here, but I do think that it's worth, you know, at least talking a little bit about some of those missteps. So could you tell us what are some of the big ways that she gets things wrong, and especially in her presentation of North American peoples in those Pottermore essays?
Absolutely. And I should say, starting out here, that the article that you mentioned is online for free now. And if anyone goes to my website, which is amyhsturgis.com, and just clicks on my articles, there's a link right to it if you want to read the whole thing. But my short version critique of her approach here is two main points. The first is that Rowling made Native Americans bit players or set dressing on their own home stage. And she did this by making the story all about white characters, replanting wholesale their institution from Europe, and relying on tired stereotypes like, you know, Native wizards were great with plants, but you don't get magical technology or organization until the whites bring them.
Yeah, they're wands, right?
Exactly. Exactly. They're using wandless magic until they're, you know, provided by the beneficent whites with this technology. She throws a mishmash of symbolism together from Native nations across the continent with no explanation of how it all came together, and some pretty poor, even factually erroneous, you know, history thrown in. So there's the fact that she sort of erases these characters to begin with, even though she chose to come to North America, she just didn't really want to deal with North Americans except in the most cursory, shallow kind of symbolic way. Mm-hmm. But the other critique, and the more I think about it, the more I just find it amazing that this actually happened. And I think about it a lot, to be honest. Rowling treats the Native population, all the different Native nations, as something exotic and extinct, no longer present or living. And let me explain what I mean by that. She repurposes the story of the Skinwalkers for her own magical world. Now, the Skinwalker concept is something sacred to nations like the Navajo today, and not discussed in public out of respect. And Rowling writes that the witches and wizards were taking on animal form, thus becoming skinwalkers, to escape persecution because, quote, derogatory rumors often originated with nomad medicine men who were sometimes faking magical powers themselves and fearful of exposure, end quote. Okay, medicine men are religious and cultural leaders today. They're the repositories of Native language and cultural oral history, healing. Rowling would not write about priests or imams or rabbis as charlatans or fakes, yeah. Right? She wouldn't say, well, you might have a tradition about them, but I'm going to come and make them part of my own story and sort of set them up as the butt of the joke.
Villains, yeah.
Exactly. And I remember Navajo author Brian Young tweeting that part in particular broke his heart. And he wrote, if it wasn't for my medicine man, I wouldn't have overcome my suicidal thoughts and depression. And here it's the sort of, again, like you said, sort of the mustache twirling villain of the piece. And she's acting as if there are no people who believe these things anymore, yeah, that these good cultural traits are back there with, you know, you get Fluffy the three-headed dog from Cerberus, and that's an ancient culture and an ancient civilization, and we can talk about it now because that time and place is gone. But Native America is alive, and American, you know, culture is suffused with it in many ways, but locking Native America up into the museum of our minds in a cultural way is a terrible act of erasure to people who are here. And it again, I just say, you know, she wouldn't have treated Christianity or Judaism or Islam or other world religions that are alive today in the same way. And so my critique was she really didn't think things through when she just took on the subject in the way that she clearly had prepared and done her homework when she brought other traditions and other histories into her work.
You know, what you said is just so profoundly important. I almost don't want to ask a follow-up question about it because I think it's, I mean, that is so important to bear in mind, that it's not only that she didn't really do her research carefully, it's that she sort of doesn't acknowledge that there's anything to be done, that it's like they don't really exist for her. And your word erasure, I think, is such an important one, as well, as we're thinking about this. You know, I've been doing some work on her Pottermore essays because I think she's playing historian, right? We've talked about how she likes to use different genre styles, John, and she is, in this case, I think, trying to take on the genre of telling a history of the magical world when she's on doing her Pottermore essays. And I think she does a pretty good job merging, like, real European historical trends with the magical history that she's trying to create here, too. I think that's one of the really interesting things she's doing. I think there are a lot of good insights that we can get from that. But she has this big blind spot when she tries to do that with North America, mm-hmm. when she's looking at North American history and trying to create some intersection with her wizarding world. And I think, and I'm in total agreement with you on this, I think some of this is she doesn't really know North American history. Mm-hmm. She doesn't know it. She wasn't steeped in it the way she was in her education with, you know, the traditions of Europe. And yet I also think that blind spot, and this maybe goes to the second part of what you're talking about, comes from the fact that she is English. And she has taken in a colonizing viewpoint that she doesn't even seem to be fully conscious of. She's got a colonial perspective that she is acting out in these Pottermore essays about North America that she's not aware of. And I thought I would just sort of mention, because I'm interested in the same thing, and I know I've gotten your advice about some of this too, Amy. The historian David Cannadine wrote a book called Ornamentalism, How the British Saw Their Empire, and he argued that the British were using colonized territories to try to reinvent or reimagine, even improve their own class system in a new place. Like they're writing their own history onto this colonized territory, which has to then be kind of empty in order for them to do that. And I think that is really the same mistake that J.K. Rowling is making in this imaginary history when she's writing about North America. She wants to create a more egalitarian territory, and you hear her talk about this in the Pottermore stuff all the time, all the egalitarian parts of North American magical community.
Right.
But the things that she's not aware of, like what you're talking about, the way that she's unconsciously denigrating Native Americans, and you and I talked about how then they just disappear. Like after
right.
the first essay or so, like they're not even there. They're not talked about. And she also, you know, she has, you know, I think about how in the Fantastic Beasts movie, Serafina is African-American, the president of the magical community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, would that really happen in the 1920s in America? She's trying to create egalitarianism, but in doing so, she's marginalizing the actual history of North America, which is very much about the destruction of indigenous culture and, in fact, racial inequalities. She seems uncomfortable about acknowledging when she goes back in time. But sorry, that was my monologue there. But I just wanted to say that I'm on board, and I think that this leads us to a lot of interesting discussions about her in this North American venue. I think one of the things that we might think about, though, and I always try to. Because I do love J.K. Rowling,
right.
and I feel some compassion for her. You know, one of the things that we've been talking about is how she does a lot of allusion, right? She's trying to make references as a way to give us something new. And, you know, is there something good about what she's doing, I guess I'm saying? Or is there a real distinction and she's mucking it up so much that it really is not redeemable?
I think there have been some really important things that she has done. I don't see that happening right now. And I, of course, my understanding is that we're moving away from North America completely in the next film. I don't know what's going to happen with the materials that come out there, but if this was her shot to do North America, that makes me sad, frustrated.
Right.
But I think there have been some very powerful things that she has done. And if I can make a pitch here, I did write an essay called Seeking Dumbledore's Mother, Harry Potter in the Native American Context, in Harry Potter for Nerds, Volume 2, which you co-edited.
Right.
Where I talked about some of the metaphors that she used in the past, some of the ways she wrote about the wizarding world before she wrote about specifically North America, were actually quite useful in thinking about North America. For example, she discusses forced removal and genocide using the giants and the goblin wars, and cultural theft with the goblins, and institutionalized inequality with the werewolves. And she even provided a kind of metaphor in reverse through Harry's experience at Privet Drive, where he is essentially in bondage and trying his aunt and uncle trying to make him pass as something he is not, mm-hmm. and Hogwarts, where he is free to be himself and explore his own background and heritage, a kind of metaphor in reverse for the tragic and traumatic residential school policy that was imposed on Native Americans across the United States and Canada for over 100 years, lasting well into living memory, 1980s, and devastated many populations, and that was and other people have written about this before I have. This is a great way to be able to talk about this, because you can already assume that we have this text in common, because it is the shared text of multiple generations now, Harry Potter. So
Absolutely.
Using that as a way then to open up and talk about these historical realities, very useful. But to go back to her Pottermore essays, she brings up literally the idea of the boarding school with Native America and doesn't flinch and just runs roughshod over it, apparently not realizing that this is an ongoing open wound. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so I don't see her now sort of living up to the same promise she showed before, but I did see the original Harry Potter series, despite the fact it never mentioned up until the very end, when Dumbledore's mother was identified as looking Native American, and I thought that was tremendously exciting. She wasn't addressing it directly, and yet so many of the things she talked about could be used for fruitful discussions and fruitful explorations of Native America in teaching and writing and thinking about these concepts. I just don't see it now, and I hope that will change.
So since you had the MuggleNet Academia discussion, J.K. Rowling has added some things, right? Like there's the Ilvermorny sorting into houses, and of course we've had the Fantastic Beasts movie. It doesn't sound like you think she has made any steps in the right direction there, but I wondered if you could tell us, like, what are some of, how should we understand the way that she's talking about, you know, that, and frankly, the way that the Ilvermorny houses are divided, and of course, Ilvermorny, a school that is has a European name, is founded by an Irish immigrant who I'm sure she thinks of as the underdog in this situation. Without, and then she has the previous homeschooling Native Americans coming to the wizard school without sort of thinking about what that might seem like. But anyway, I'm sort of stealing maybe some of your answers here. But what do you think about the way that she has handled some of the additional revelations that she's had? And then if we go, you know, forward to the, I guess it's the 1920s with Fantastic Beasts, how you think she dealt with that, with the movie there?
Yes, like you said, I don't see any great turn away from the pattern she had already established, which is surprising in a way, because, for example, the Ilvermorny reveals came after the initial backlash that got so much press Huffington Post and lots of places ran articles about it. And then we still get these symbols that are sort of a hodgepodge taken from different peoples. It isn't explained why a New England school with people who came to New England and settled there and never left New England would know about all of these symbols from, you know, the American Southwest, for example, nations out there. And, of course, the imagery that we get, for example, the pictures that came out with the sorting, you know, have Celtic knots all over, all over. So, you know, it actually speaks to your point about the sort of perhaps a kind of colonizing unconscious force there that she may not even realize what it is that she's doing. But also, as you say, then the actual characters who are native, even the fantastical ones, and of course you get you get the whole renamed with an English name bit, and
all, which
again goes back to the whole residential school thing, where children were taken forcibly from their families and not allowed to use their names or their language, given new names, given a new language, and essentially that was built on the whole kill the Indian, save the man philosophy. And it, just uncomfortable shadowings there. And then we have a glancing vision view of a character who appears to be a sort of generic cinematic Indian, right? The kind of thing that you would see in a sort of 1950s film, where a little bit of this and a little bit of that, you can't really tell what the background would be, just something generically identifiable as American Indian in a scene there in the film. But there's just not a lot there to unpack. It's mostly invisibility and silence, and which is also mostly her reaction to the feedback that she's gotten or the critiques that have been made.
Right.
So I don't...
A sort of non-reaction. It was just...
Exactly.
Sort of, right.
I mean, I want to jump in and say two things. One, I gave a talk recently at Rose State College here in Oklahoma, and I was talking to the students that had gathered before the talk, and one of them was a young Native American woman. And I brought up this point because Hogwarts in America, Dr. Sturgis's brilliant piece in Reason, had just come out, and I asked her if she'd seen it. She said, yeah, she'd listened to the podcast at Muggle Tech Academia. And I said, how closely is this felt by the Native American community here? And she said, to us, the school program was genocide. And when she said genocide, she looked at me with a look like I had done it. I mean, there was a living rage.
Yes.
And I literally, I took a step back because it was, you know, and yet this was visceral. And I thought, as an Orthodox Christian whose people have been slaughtered by the Soviets, by, you know, the Ottoman yoke, you know, I get it. You know, I was just thinking, wow, if somebody talked to me casually about the gulag, this would be the look that I would give them. And, you know, Amy's point here is people need to read Hogwarts in America, because in it she talks about how Rowling brilliantly subverts the schoolboy genre from an empire delivering value vehicle to a postmodern, you know, celebration of diversity and inclusiveness. I mean, she totally turns the thing on its head by parody. And when you read Ilvermorny, you're thinking, well, maybe this is that same kind of loving parody, but there's no subversion. You know,
right.
We get all we're left with is the poison. And as Amy wrote, Amy was the first one who brought this to my attention. That's the part that's just so doggone disappointing. Yeah, you're waiting for this thing to be turned around and all of a sudden lifted on its head, and we laugh at, you know, the Enid Blyton school thing, the way we did in Harry Potter. But here we're just left with this, you know, like blood on your hands, just doing the, are we really gonna, you know, I keep thinking of that young woman staring at me like, this was genocide. I mean, they tried to slaughter me. They tried to make, you know, basically my reason for existence, my core essence, you know, dispensable, you know, disposable. And I was thinking, yeah, okay, I get it. I'm getting it. Rowling has dropped the ball. And perhaps that's why the Ilvermorny song was cut out of the film. There seems to be some effort to put that aside. Let's go back to France. You know, let's go to some place where we can laugh at Europeans and not expose our ornamentalism, as you're pointing out. Anyway, sorry to.
No, I think that's great. Yeah, and people should definitely read Amy's original essay because you will definitely it's eye opening if this is not something that you've thought about before. Absolutely. So one of the things, Amy, that I know you have found so frustrating is, you know, as we've just been talking about, there is so much possibility in J.K. Rowling's earlier work for the representation of indigenous cultures. And one of the things that I think that you have talked about, we have talked a little bit about before, is, for example, her speech at the Harvard commencement about the importance of imagination. And I wonder, what do you think, like, if you were going to imagine her doing it better, what would that have looked like, and what might imagining better look like in this context?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, she talks in that address about taking the imaginative leap to stand in someone else's shoes and show empathy, and really that's all
right.
That she would have needed to have done there.
Imagine empathy is harder than I think people sometimes give credit for. It's
well, true.
But she, yeah, you're right. She just, if she could just put herself in that position, you would hope. Yeah.
You are quite right. I said that's only what she has to do. That is a tall order. But
well, it seems to be, I guess.
Unfortunately, just making Native America, making Indigenous people alive as actors in their own right and not just acted upon. Mm-hmm. And let her use of Native America spring from knowledge and respect and not lazy stereotypes or ignorance, something, you know, easy to churn out, because we all know what that looks like, don't we? Well, we don't. And most of all, engage with the subject when her critics react and not ignore mistakes she's made. She has, in many cases, taken opportunities to educate herself, educate her readers. Just recently we saw her say, I, you know, unequivocally apologize. I was wrong for something that she said. She has a habit of creating teachable moments, and this could have been one of those. And it still could be. It still could be. Mm-hmm. If she would go about this, just allow Native America to be alive. And I do want to say, I want to make it 100% clear, I don't think it is impossible for people of non-Native background to borrow from or incorporate Native elements into their work in a respectful and powerful way. I want to encourage people to learn from and share knowledge about, you know, the Cherokee Nation, all of the other First Nations on the continent. But to my way of thinking, appropriation is like, well, it's like a smash and grab burglary, you know, where someone reaches in through a window she's broken, grabs anything she can reach, whether she knows what it is or not, and runs with it. And that's not good art. And I wouldn't write a story about physics without consulting a physicist. And it's not a huge leap to say maybe you shouldn't write about Indigenous peoples without first being a student of Indigenous peoples. You know, mm-hmm. Talk to people, do the research. It's not rocket scientists or science. It's not rocket scientists. Okay, Sturgis. and I've seen it done. An example: PC and Kristen Cast, in their House of Night young adult vampire series, which is set in my hometown of Tulsa, has a part Cherokee main character, who also has a Cherokee grandmother who plays an important role in the novels. And the novels are so much richer because they incorporate real Cherokee mythology. like the Ravenmockers, into this magical landscape. Real Cherokee lifeways and language and contemporary Oklahoma realities like the growth of lavender farms in the countryside. There's real texture, there's real depth, there's resonance, and it also educates, which is something Rowling in the past has done very well in her work. They treat a Cherokee holy woman on the same standing as Catholic nuns, her faith with the same respect they give Christianity. And these ingredients in their stories weren't stuck on half-heartedly in the 11th hour to signal some kind of inclusiveness that really isn't there, like, for example, the house names of Ilvermorny. Mm-hmm. You know, these ingredients are central to the cast's novels, and they did their homework, and they had people they spoke to and helped them with their research and served as first readers who could make sure that what they were doing was informed and thoughtful and respectful. And that's a win-win. People learn about the culture. People learn that, you know, these people are here, that they're alive, they have a vibrant culture, and it informs the magic in such interesting ways. That would be my dream, that if there's the opportunity for that, that North America wouldn't end up being, by the time she's writing about it in the early 20th century, devoid of any kind of indigenous influence, that it doesn't have, you know, wouldn't have to be the movie of Native America. It could just have characters and have them be authentic and real. Mm-hmm. Just do, you know, the same kind of due diligence she did with her earlier works. That would be a dream. Or at the very least, just to acknowledge the criticisms that have come up, engage that in some way, because she never has. She has responded to tweets about other aspects of the Pottermore essays, but never Native America. And that's, you know, it's kind of another erasure. You know, when you're just not even given enough credit to get a response, when she's proven very willing to interact with her readers in other ways.
It's like, I think it's like maybe it's hard for her to even confront it within herself, perhaps.
And your work does suggest that a lot of this is unconscious, and she may not recognize it, and that might just, like you say, that might be a difficult thing to come to terms with.
She has been told. She has been told.
I think there's. I mean, I'm not going to excuse this, but I think there's an easy explanation for how this happened, and that's that Rowling is a novelist. That her primary work is the novels that she's writing. She's neck deep in Cormoran Strike. That the relative to the Harry Potter work or Cormoran Strike, that Fantastic Beasts and the Pottermore essays are ad hoc things that she did to protect the franchise from Warner Brothers that wanted to make a Fantastic Beasts travelogue, you know, Indiana Jones type travelogue with CGI. And that she invented this story that was going to be a one-off, and then it turned into three, and now it's into five, and you know, basically it's become a Lumos charity fundraiser. That's her focus, is to make money for Lumos and her goals for basically the elimination of institutionalized childcare globally. And you see that kind of ad hoc. It's an entirely different character and quality of her work on Pottermore and Ilvermorny. This backstory.
She's just not putting the attention into it that she
did with
the other
things. And what you get, what's disturbing about that then, is the two things. One, we see what her backstory is. What Rowling is when she's just casually writing something. She can come off with something which is ornamentalist colonialism.
Right.
And as you know, as Amy's just pointed out, why not an apology? I mean, when she was confronted with the Robert Galbraith, you know, pseudonym, that she had basically decided she was just going to put on the persona of a veteran who had been disabled. She donated all the profits from Cormoran Strike to a veterans fund, and that continues to this day. You know, more than a generous gesture for, frankly, a less disturbing failure. anyway.
Yeah, I think you're really onto something, John.
There's an explanation. That's not an excuse. But I don't think it's very difficult to see that Rowling has not invested in Fantastic Beasts anything like what she does with she did with the Hogwarts saga or with Cormoran Strike.
And it shows how problematic it can be when you're being so casual with other people's territories and histories and so on. Yeah.
Right. Right.
So, Amy, you have also, I think, I'm glad you've brought up other examples of people who are doing Native American literature, particularly in the sci-fi fantasy genre. You have recently edited a double issue of the journal Apex, which is all about science fiction, horror, fantasy. And this is the August 2017 Apex magazine, which is a celebration of indigenous American fantasists. There is so much wonderful material in that issue. I hope that our listeners will go check it out. There's fiction, great short stories. There's also critical scholarship. And in particular, relevant to our discussion, I think, right now, is an essay about an essay by Daniel Heath Justice called Indigenous Wonderworks and the Settler Colonial Imaginary. And this is really an excerpt from his forthcoming book. And I wondered if you could just give us a little bit of an idea of what Daniel Heath Justice thinks that genres, particularly the fantasy genre, why does he think they're so important for emerging indigenous authors to engage with?
Absolutely. Thank you for bringing that up. And I would like to invite all the listeners to come check it out. It is online for free. All of the pieces have been unlocked now, so they are readily available for free. If you go to apex-magazine.com, you're looking for the August 2017 issue. That's issue 99. So why does Daniel Heath Justice find the genre so important? First, there's a practical reason. He says that it has been discovered and proven that documented that genre fiction, speculative fiction, science fiction, fantasy, horror, is the primary literary fiction read by indigenous audiences. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to reach these readers, go where they are, right? So that's a practical reason. But he also is arguing for the transformative power of the imagination, which I think has, like you mentioned earlier, some deep resonances with what Rowling said in her commencement address and elsewhere. He says this kind of literature preserves and empowers, and it shows Native people's possibilities. If I can share a little quote here, he says that these kinds of works show, quote, not generic landscapes, but specific places with histories, voices, memories. They carry the past forward. They give us a future, even if it's only an imagined one. But without that imagined possibility, it's all too easy to believe we don't belong there. And that's a road to a very frightening place indeed, end quote. And so he's imagining that imagination, essentially, can anticipate transformative change, that if we imagine better, we can have better. But first, we have to make that leap.
And I love the way that he talks about realism in comparison with fantasy, and how realism, I mean, in a way, realism is just a real downer. And all you're talking about are all the horrible, things that are going wrong and all of the bad stuff. But if you want to be more inspirational, if you want to have something that provokes ideas and instead of just, sadness or, even compassion, but if you want something that, has more ability to kind of attract people's imagination and put them into the position of thinking about the future and maybe even solutions or better ways, that fantasy is really the way to do that.
Exactly. And sort of gearing ourselves up to make that happen. So he says, freedom of love, of desire, of life, of culture, political survival, these are only realized through the linking of our courage to our imaginations. Mm-hmm. So the idea that if we can imagine it, we can be brave enough then to try to make it happen. I think that's beautiful. And I think it's the key to unlocking so much potential. It gives imaginative literature gives alternatives to that realism that you were talking about, that this is the way it's always been, so it's going to be the way it is in the future because it's the way it's always been. This is the door that lets you out of that trap, and it's imaginative literature.
Yeah, he also talks about this, what he calls the savagism versus civilization binary, that he sees as a problematic part of adventure and fantasy novels, and he actually sort of specifically mentions J.R.R. Tolkien in this regard. And so my question to you is, in terms of the savagism and civilization binary, do you think that J.K. Rowling might be falling into that construct in a negative way?
Oh, interesting.
I surprised
that would
you with that question,
a lot.
But
you did. You did. I'm making notes to self here on my little pad of paper as we go. This is great. I think you could make a strong argument that that's what's happening. And I should point out, he is a fan of Tolkien. So when he's saying this about Tolkien, he's basically saying you have to appreciate he is caught in a trap or a limitation of the imagination himself, because he is only seeing things from a particular context. So he's not saying never read Tolkien. That would not occur to him. But he is saying there's got to be a way to get out of this trap. And similarly, then, you could say don't throw Rowling out with the bathwater, but appreciate that she has her limitations too, and maybe if we imagine better, we can imagine a way outside of those limitations, so we don't get caught in the cultural moorings, the short-sightedness, the myopia. We can actually liberate the fantastic from these bounds or bindings, and open it up to be bigger and better, more powerful and more relevant.
So he talks about the term wonderworks, which he suggests as maybe even an alternative way to talk about especially indigenous fantasy writings. Can you explain what he means by this term wonderworks, and why it is particularly well suited to talking about Native American fantasy?
Yes, he says, I mean, he's thinking about speculative fiction. He's thinking about science fiction and fantasy and horror. But as you pointed out, he thinks, for example, many notions of fantasy are coiled up in that colonial mindset, tied up in that savagism versus civilization template. And template is an interesting word that he uses. It's again, this is the way we do it because this is the way it has been done. And so he's trying to find a way to liberate people from that. And part of it, he says, is also there is a fluidity, there's a blurriness to the line between, say, magical realism and the realistic and the speculative. It's not as easy to draw very clear boundaries when indigenous authors write speculative fiction. And he says, let's just throw all this stuff out for a minute and let's use a word that really captures what we're going for. And he goes to wonder and says, wonder, there's astonishment, there's admiration, there's even a little bit of mindful fear. But when we talk about the wondrous, he says, we're thinking that things are other and otherwise, right? And so here it comes back to, if we take the imaginative leap and say it doesn't have to be the way it's always been, we can see alternate possibilities. That's all bound up in his notion then of wonder.
I was thinking, you know, wonder is like a question and not an answer. And that's maybe the perfect thing for speculative fiction. And it doesn't bind you, because what you said, everything is other, because you haven't arrived at an answer if you're in that state of wondering.
Exactly. The whole nature of that is asking what if. Mm-hmm. It's not, like you say, it's not the answer, it's the question. Oh, that's beautifully put.
Oh, thank you. But I was really struck by such a great essay. I hope that people will look at it, will read it, and be inspired. And I think one of the things that's really cool about this issue of the magazine that you've put together is that you actually get to read some great, what do you call it, indigenous wonderworks. Some wonderful short stories in there. There's one that, and I'm going to say the name wrong so you can correct me, Amy. It's something like Your Authentic Indian Experience, TM.
Yes.
Is that Rebecca Roanhorse?
Yes.
That is really great. And it struck me what you were talking about with the Pottermore, you know, that it's I don't want to spoil it too much, but it has to do with a virtual reality Indian experience and a vision quest. And what is it to be an authentic Native American versus what she sort of calls pretendians, which I thought was a funny way to describe it. And where is authenticity in the experience? And it is an imagination, but wow, does that hits home. And it's really about appropriation in a very powerful way that I think maybe J.K. Rowling should have a look at what Rebecca Roanhorse has done there. I think she would find that. I hope it would hit home. But what a great use of you know, a kind of futurism genre of writing.
Yeah, and that WonderWorks vocabulary piece is no small thing, because when we say imaginative literature, if you're talking about it from what someone like Tolkien would understand, that to him imagination is referring to a Coleridgean idea of imagination, which is really about a transpersonal spiritual faculty in the human being rather than a subjective, you know, fancy, an idea of someone's opinion that is almost worthless in terms of reality. When Rowling talks about imagination, she's talking about it in light of Tolkien and Coleridge, and yet she doesn't grasp what this author does with his WonderWorks suggestion, is that today it comes with baggage that restricts how we understand imaginative literature. Mm-hmm. WonderWorks really is a brilliant supplanting and a return to a Coleridgean and a much larger idea of imagination than before. I mean, I think this was an invaluable idea. I think Tolkien would have embraced it. Amy, you're the Tolkien scholar. What did you think?
I love what you just said. Absolutely, I'm on board with your reading there. I think Tolkien would find it very refreshing and would be open to the implied critique there, but much more excited by the sort of unleashing and the frankly spiritual aspect of this too. I'm completely by the notion that Tolkien would have been excited by this essay. And by the way, the book that is going to be coming out is at the end of the year by Daniel Heath Justice is Why Indigenous Literatures Matter. So this is one of the literatures he's discussing, but it is very near and dear to his heart, of course, as it is to mine. So I was just thrilled that we had this opportunity to share his insights, you know, even before the book came out.
And I think in the context of the magazine, where you're also showcasing some indigenous, you know, speculative fiction, you've got WonderWorks there, and then you've got some of the theory behind it. I think that's a great experience for readers also. I found that to be very eye-opening.
Yeah, seriously, this Apex collection is invaluable. I, speaking as a non-Native American living and I assume the most densely populated state with Native Americans, his comments about deficit remains the defining trope for indigenous people in the settler colonial imagery, and his thing about this savagism versus civilization binary being the world building template for fantasy fiction, it literally had me just sitting back thinking, there it is, you know, that's my blind spot, and you know, shaking, just literally thinking, wow, I'm still carrying this baggage. I consider myself to be a fairly woke person or whatever, and that his confronting me with my blind spot was simultaneously gentle but bracing. You know, there's just no denying it when you're confronted with it. So, as Katie just said, to have that essay paired with pieces by Native Americans that illustrate that this can be done Wow, it's a powerful and important contribution, Amy.
From what you've said too, Amy, it's pretty clear that Indigenous authors are embracing sci-fi fantasy, this whole WonderWorks idea. Indigenous futurism is another term that's commonly used. Is this creating sort of this genre writing? Is this creating communities of Indigenous authors and readers who are able to come together? And I guess readers who are not, you know, not only Indigenous people, but people who come from all over. Is this creating kind of a, you know, an intellectual cultural community that could be fertile ground?
It is. It's so exciting to see. This is just a great time to care, to be perfectly honest, because there is this sense of an emerging community. Like I said, there have been great Native authors of speculative fiction for decades, but this is a moment. There is a thing happening. One of the terms that is being used is indigenerds. Nerds who are Indigenous. And so you can go to a place, for example, a tribe called Geek, which is a tribe called geek.com. And Tribe Called Geek is a radio show that's also a podcast. It's a website. And it's dedicated to bringing indigenerdity to the geeks at the powwow. There's now an Indigenous Comic-Con. In fact, they had the first one last year. It was such an overwhelming success. They're going to have another one in November of this year. So if you go to indigenouscomiccon.com, you can find out about what's happening there in Albuquerque. They're calling it the Gathering of the Indigenerds. And people are noticing. I mean, there's a desire to want to go to the source and understand what's happening here. So another place I would point to and say, yes, we can see this is happening because here is evidence. Another great magazine, Strange Horizons. If you go to strangehorizons.com, this is open, this is free access. They ran in January a selection called, or a collection called Decolonizing Science Fiction and Imagining Futures, an Indigenous Futurisms Roundtable. And that included Rebecca Roanhorse, whose story you were just talking about from Apex, Elizabeth Lapincy and Johnny Jay, and Darcy Little Badger. And Darcy Little Badger is another author I think incredibly highly of. And in that roundtable, where they just discuss why is Indigenous futurism important, Darcy Little Badger says, "I think that imagining a future, period, is a great start. Please, please, please give me stories that acknowledge we survived the 1800s. I've had my fill of Apaches and Westerns and historical fantasies, which is saying a lot since Native American characters, even secondary ones, are so rare. Both in and outside fiction, we are pushed to the past tense. The reality is many Indigenous cultures in North America survived an apocalypse. The key word is survived. Any future with us in it, triumphant and flourishing, is a hopeful one." And I can hardly read that without tearing up.
Oh, I know. Wow, it's wonderful.
But there's this wonderful discussion. I've already used this in one of my Native American courses, this whole roundtable, and it just strikes people between the eyes. The desire to be present and the desire to be part of a vision of the future, mm-hmm. how key this is, and again, that imaginative leap. So yes, we are in a moment, and it's a moment not only where Indigenous authors want to reach Indigenous readers, but it is a moment where, you know, non-natives are welcome to come and learn a different perspective and see things from a different point of view and have, you know, their worldviews expanded and take that empathetic leap into someone else's shoes.
So exciting. That's really cool. And you've already mentioned some authors that maybe our listeners might want to take a look at, but are there other people that you would say, you know, if somebody's just delving into Indigenous WonderWorks, some of the favorite ones that you've read, or people who are producing some of the great stuff out there now.
Oh, yes. Actually, there is a couple of collections that I would point to where you can see a whole range of authors, to be honest. Walking the Clouds, an anthology of indigenous science fiction, which was edited by Grace Dillon, is a terrific book. It's a great starting place, too, because it goes back and looks at things that were written decades ago, as well as bringing it up to the present tense. There's Moonshot, the Indigenous Comics Collection, Volumes 1 and 2. Volume 1 came out in 2015, and Volume 2 came out in 2017. A lot of different authors and artists there. And if I can make a little plug, I've done several of my Looking Back on Genre History segments on Starship Sofa about Native American science fiction. So, and I have another one coming up next month that tries to bring us up to the present day. I'm talking about people like Daniel H. Wilson, whose Robopocalypse series was a bestseller. He's got a new book out. Also a Cherokee from Oklahoma. So there you go. But a number of different authors. And so I've if you go to my website and look at podcasts, you'll find the selections where I just did an entire segment recommending authors. There's also scholarship, as we've talked about with Daniel Heath Justice's work, and a great place to start there, free, online, easy access, the science fiction journal Extrapolation, which has been around for decades. It was one of the first great academic journals about science fiction, dedicated an entire issue to indigenous futurisms, volume 57 in 2016. And if you go to Liverpool University Press, or just Google Liverpool University Press, and the name of the journal is Extrapolation, you can find that volume 57, 2016, which is fresh new scholarship about indigenous authors writing science fiction. So there's a lot of exciting stuff out there. Drew Hayden Taylor is another one who just he released a new collection of his short stories, Take Me to Your Chief, which is a science fiction collection. Lots of interesting, exciting things going on.
Oh my gosh, that just sounds so rich and vibrant. I've just been trying to scramble to write all that stuff down.
That's right.
You got the reading list for the next couple of months there. That's wonderful. And so good to see so much energy there. And, you know, I hope in some ways that J.K. Rowling's work, you know, I hope that Indigenous people who enjoy J.K. Rowling's work will maybe imagine better and produce some great stuff.
That's the irony of this, isn't it? Amy was talking about it being the shared text. How many of these authors have not read the Hogwarts Saga? I mean, in some sense, you know, Rowling has so legitimized fantasy as it's no longer considered to be a minor or a diminished form of real writing.
Right.
That Rowling, in a way, has informed and inspired a lot of this work, which makes, again, this failure with Ilvermorny so disappointing. Anyway, sorry for that screed.
And I think, you know, that's the hope, and, you know, maybe we can pass the torch, you know, we can sort of pass things along to another generation of people who have a particular interest in this, who won't be just sort of casual and offhanded and appropriating, as opposed to, I think the word you used is cross-pollinating, Amy, which I guess is really what the aim would be there. So we are about out of time here. I'm sorry to say, what a fascinating conversation this has been. Our last question, though, Amy, is the sort of big one. This lets you imagine better. now, I know you take on projects all the time. I'm always amazed at how prolific you are. But let's just say...
Pot calling the kettle black.
Oh, my gosh. Well, no. Let's just say, if you won a MacArthur Genius Grant tomorrow, and you could just focus on a particular thing and just invest all of your time and energy into it, what would you be turning your attention to and why?
Oh, what a question.
I know.
Oh, goodness.
It's a big one.
Okay. Well, there are so many good intellectual histories of Western science fiction, going all the way back to antiquity, Greek and Roman proto-science fiction, to modern science fiction in the UK, France, and the United States. But today, with the community's enthusiasm for science fiction and translation, we see more and more Hugos, for example, going to international science fiction, and a more cosmopolitan view of world SF. We're in this moment where we're getting collections of and histories of other robust SF traditions, East Asian SF, Latin American SF, African SF, and Indigenous American SF, right? So if I had the grant and an unlimited amount of time and caffeine, it would be a dream to create a more integrated history of science fiction. This kind of, you know, big picture, big history work that would trace the development of science fiction across the globe, you know, from antiquity to the present, and bring these different traditions of SF into perspective with each other through their evolutions. I truly believe science fiction is a conversation. And it's also a global phenomenon. And I would like all traditions of science fiction to kind of speak to each other. All those ideas, just glorious. I'd just like to be able to in some small way, be a part of the scholarship of integration that brings these wonderful histories of separate strands of science fiction together to say, and here is our human story of science fiction.
Oh my gosh, Amy, let's talk to these MacArthur people, because I think you should totally do this.
Yeah.
This needs to exist, Amy.
That's beautiful. I want to ask you one more question.
Oh, sure.
Forgive me, Katie. Okay, we're going to go off the charts here. I did a survey of about 5,000 people before the summer school started. I know the two of you got that thing. And one of the things I asked was if you could ask, you know, one question of me, what would it be, you know, so I make sure I cover it in the summer school. Well, a lot of people wrote back, and the interesting thing was a lot of them, it was all over the map, as you can imagine, but a lot of them said, John, if you had one question that you could ask the presence, J.K. Rowling, what would it be?
Wow.
And I talked about that in my second summer school class because it was about alchemy, and I said, actually, that was actually the first class. I said my question would be about, you know, your sources. How did you come up with all the literary alchemy inside this book? Is it Angela Carter? Is it Nabokov? Is it C.S. Lewis? Or is it something really you just decided to invent on your own out of Shakespeare? I mean, it's an important subject to me. I want to turn that on you, Amy, and say I should say when you meet J.K. Rowling, and it's not at one of these, you know, you've got 4 seconds while she signs your books, you know, meet and greet thing. But if you actually, you can sit down in the Rowling Manor, the Murray Manor, and chat with her and say, okay, I get my one question. Here's my one question. Would it be about Ilvermorny, or have you got something larger? Or I don't know if larger, more personal that you want to talk to her about?
Oh my goodness, mind blown! Okay,
that's a tough one, John. That's a tough question.
It really is. I don't think I would go the Ilvermorny route, because I'm down in black and white what I thought about all of that, and I don't know that I'd get an answer, because we haven't had an answer yet.
That's right. It's like asking her for a plot point in a book that she's writing. You know you're not going to get that answer. You know, it's just going to be...
Right, exactly.
Great question, but I'm not going to answer it. Thanks. Thanks a bunch. I've blown my one wish to the genie. Doggone it.
Exactly. Oh, my goodness. part of me would like to ask her about the notion of canon and about keeping things to herself versus opening it up to other people writing. But part of me, I mean, if I'm just going to go with the sort of gut instinct thing, I shouldn't go with my gut instinct. I'm not the kind of person. I need to sit and think about something for 15 hours before I can come up with an idea. But I do wonder if we would ever have seen any of this if her mother had lived.
Hmm.
And in a lot of ways, I think this is, we are, and this is, I'm not saying anything new. Both of you have alluded to this before, and so have a lot of other people. We have seen J.K. Rowling essentially herself therapy through these works. Like many other authors, they're working through the things that perplex them. And I would like, if I had a chance to talk to her, I think I would like to get something as personal as possible. So I think I'd try to ask something open-ended about if you'd had a good relationship with your father, if your mother had lived, would we have ever seen any of this? You know, if you had lived, had the childhood that you wish you had, does that mean you would trade that and you would lose Harry Potter?
Wow. Now, Amy, I love that because you are asking her to do a kind of thought experiment, speculate at the same time, which I think we're talking about this, that can be so productive. How interesting. Wow.
Thank you.
Wow.
All right. Ask me in 20 minutes and I'll give you a completely different answer. But
that was your gut. That was on the spot.
There you go.
Well, thank you so much, Amy.
Oh, this has been such a joy to spend this time with two of my absolute favorite people and in a friendly audience where I do want to make it clear I love Rowling's work and it's played a huge role in my life, but it's important to be able to talk about these things and I appreciate having the friendly, receptive, and incredibly insightful, comments and welcome here to be able to talk about these things. It means a lot, and I'm grateful to both of you.
Thank you, Amy, and I think we didn't say this at the beginning, but, you know, you're the reason that John and I know each other. So how about that?
Yeah.
So circles within circles. Yeah. You're the one who put me and John on the same panel together at the
That's right.
Conference.
Yeah, knowing that I was about to be, didn't we use the word eviscerate earlier?
No.
I mean, I was cut apart by Katie. I'm ready to speak, and this woman on stage is saying, as some bonehead has observed in his book, incorrectly.
I was very apologetic. I felt very shitty about it, actually, but you were such a good sport. Well, again, thank you, Amy, for being on the podcast today and sharing your very interesting thoughts about not only Harry Potter and the Native American tradition, but also fascinating Native American sci-fi and fantasy writing that is going on right now. And I think that we all need to really be thinking about using this term wonderworks in a very broad sense. What a great new term to have. Once again,
yes.
Amy is the guest editor of the August 2017 issue of Apex Magazine, where you will find lots of fascinating reading if you're interested in pursuing this area further, including, I should say, a story on ghosts that did make me think a lot about that sort of idea of how you're wrestling with death and grief through science fiction writing. So, interesting connection to your last answer there. And thanks to you, John, as always. Thank you, John Granger, for being our continuing expert guest. Listeners, be on the alert for signups for classes from John. I hope that you'll be able to take advantage of that. I can't imagine somebody better to learn about Harry Potter from than John Granger. What a great opportunity he is providing the whole world. I'd also like to give a big thanks to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Thank you for all you do, Emma.
Yay!
I am not exaggerating when I say, Emma, we could not do this without you, and we are so glad that you're part of our team. I also wanted to give a special shout-out today to the musicians behind our opening and closing music, Harry Potter scholars Travis Prinzi and Emily Strand. Yes, that is the kind of intellect we have behind this great music. I love the music. It gives us such great accompaniment, and I hope our listeners have been enjoying it too. As always, we appreciate very much our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Harry Potter fan site. And that includes especially Amy Hogan. I just wanted to say thanks to Amy for helping us get launched. And we are excited to be continuing our relationship there. And speaking of MuggleNet, dear listeners, we are so glad that you joined us, and we would love it if you would leave a comment or question for us. And you can do that on MuggleNet, or you can send us an email, or we also have a Twitter. All of that is available via MuggleNet. We'd especially like to know what you're interested in hearing more about, because I hope that what we're seeing here each week is that Hogwarts headmaster and supreme mugwump of the International Confederation of Wizards, Albus Dumbledore, he was absolutely right when he said, "Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." We'll see you next time when we'll be using our words to make some magic.